Good afternoon. Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we've got a topic which affects every single person who can hear my voice right now, which is federal spending in Alaska. A huge part of our economy, a really big part of our history, the military spending that built Anchorage, the health spending, which takes care of more than half of our citizens, as we heard on yesterday's show. And so that puts us in a position, presumably, of wanting to have the federal government keep spending money in Alaska. On the other hand, we're also all Americans. And we presumably want our country to continue to go on strong and to succeed and to have a good economy. And there's a lot of concern that that might not happen because of the amount of deficit and debt that our country is in. So how do we balance these two? What does it mean to be an Alaskan and to be an American at the same time on the two sides of this dichotomy of federal spending? Well, I've got two terrific guests to talk about this today. Scott Goldsmith is a professor at the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research. Scott has been studying the Alaska economy for decades, and I would dare say that there's probably nobody else around who knows more about federal spending and its impacts in Alaska. He's got the economic models that can tell us about what that money does as it flows through our economy. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here.
And my other guest is Jeff Pantages, who's Chief Investment Officer at Alaska Permanent Capital Management Company, which is an institutional investment firm here in Anchorage. Jeff has written extensively for the newspaper and opinion columns, and he's in the marketplace every day looking at how interest rates change and how federal spending affects the markets, which ultimately affect the economy. And I want to thank you for being here, Jeff.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So to start our discussion, I would like to, I want to make sure everybody knows where to call, too, because we want to make sure this is such an important issue, and so many people have different opinions about it. I'm sure some of our listeners would want to get in on it. So I'm going to give you the number now, and I'll give it again later. It's 550-8433. That's a local call in Anchorage. If you're outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. Of course, we're on live at 2, so if you're listening at 7, it's a rebroadcast, and you shouldn't call in. You can email us at hometownalaska@ksk.org, and I'll read those messages on the air. And, and something else I want to say before we get started is that this is obviously a big political topic. That's really not our focus today, although I'm sure we'll get into it. Many people know who know me that I'm a Democrat involved in politics from a certain perspective. I volunteered for the Scott McAdams campaign, so I lay that out there. If anyone thinks I'm being unfair, please call me on it, and we'll discuss that too. So getting into the question of how federal spending affects Alaska to Scott Goldsmith, how much money are we talking about that comes into our state, and what percentage of our economy and of our jobs are affected?
The short answer is we get about $10 billion a year flowing into Alaska from the federal government. And as that money circulates through the economy, it supports about one-third of all the jobs and one-third of all the household income for Alaskans.
But that doesn't mean that one-third of the people work for the federal government.
That's right. what happens is that two things. One is that a lot of the dollars that come in don't come in through federal wages paid to civilians and the military. A lot of it goes to the state budget, which is about $3 billion. A lot of it goes directly to individuals in Social Security payments, for example. A lot of it goes directly to private businesses and nonprofits. So it's only the tip of the iceberg that is represented by federal employees.
I see. So is this money that then, do we characterize that as sort of a basic industry, so fishing, oil and gas, government spending, and then we think of other industries that are sort of handling the money that already comes in as sort of retail, for example?
Yes, that's the way I look at it. Selling our oil or selling our minerals, the federal government pumps new money into the Alaska economy, and that money circulates through the economy, producing income and jobs in industries across the board. So if you look at the banking industry or at the retail trade industry, you can say that about a third of the jobs there owe their existence to federal dollars coming in, mm-hmm. because federal employees and those other federal dollars that come in get spent locally in those industries and support those industries.
I see. So when you say a third of our jobs, you're talking about a third of the grocery store clerks, a third of the car washers, and because it's a third of the economy, and so a third of all those folks.
That's right. You could think of it that the economy would shrink by a third if all the federal dollars disappeared tomorrow,
or
the
right.
spigot were turned off.
Which is what we at least most of us probably hope doesn't happen, because we would all be camping out probably. I don't
know. Well, there's three of us in the room here today.
Yeah, right. One of us is econ, right?
Well, a bunch of those dollars are military too, right?
That's right.
Probably more stable than.
Well, that's a good question. Oh. Whether they're more stable as we look forward.
Yeah. So, turning to Jeff Pantages, my other guest, and looking kind of at the national picture, concerns have been raised. About the federal budget deficit, that it's reaching some pretty high percentages of GNP. Is that something you think we should be worried about? Is that important, and why?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think we should be worried about that as Americans, and certainly also as Alaskans. I mean, the budget deficit has been growing rapidly. Certainly the catalyst for that was the recession, the panic, really, of 2008, And we've seen government revenues go down, and we've seen government spending go up, and that means, you know, running big budget deficits. And every year we do that, we add to the debt, because that's how we fund the deficits, is we issue bonds to fund those deficits. And so the debt has been going up really very rapidly, and that debt is something like 60% now of GDP, which is as high as it's been for a long, long time. It's higher in the Second World War, but it's at 60%, and we're running annual deficits these days of over $1 trillion, and really that, again, every year that goes by, we keep adding to that debt. And eventually, it's difficult to repay the debt. You know, we're not, you know, in dire straits yet, but the trends are worrisome.
Right. Well, let's clarify for people what the kind of the likely scenarios are if we don't deal with this problem on a national basis, because, you know, we've seen what happened in Greece, where the mm-hmm. country essentially looked to be insolvent, and rioting in the streets, and the European Union had to step in with a huge package. Obviously, if that happened to a country like the United States, that's a bulwark of the whole international financial system, it would be a catastrophe of the first order. Is there anything like that in the future, or what are the consequences of sort of not addressing this problem short-term, medium-term, long-term?
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully that's not in the future, and probably not. I mean, I think that's pretty unlikely. But, you know, we do have these issues. I mean, I talked about the deficit and the debt in terms of, you know, the recession. And that's sort of a cyclical issue. Hopefully the economy gets stronger and that can go away a little bit. But we do have these long-term structural issues associated with the deficit and the debt and our country, really, namely Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those issues are driving the long-term structural deficit and then adding to the debt. So we really need to try and address those issues. Otherwise, you know, we can get into a position where people start to question the creditworthiness of the United States if the debt keeps going up and we don't seem to be able to get our political act together. Because I think, to me at least, this issue is one of politics in terms of getting the deficits and the debts under control. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen overnight. It would take a while, but we kind of have to start addressing those things soon.
Right. And just one more question to think about those consequences. It seems like that what happened in 2008 is we got to see what happens when nobody trusts the paper that's issued, right? We got to see when confidence is lost in the credit of big institutions, then you sort of start to see this abyss, and you realize, well, the whole financial system is based on trust in some way. So if we were to get to a point like that where countries would look askance at at our credit, what would happen then? Interest rates would go up.
Interest rates would go up. I mean, the only way we could attract funds and money would be to pay higher interest rates. And, of course, that's what's happening over in Europe right now, in fact. Early in the summer, we had this deficit debt crisis play out in the European Union. And the IMF came in, the European Central Bank came in to provide funds to governments to help them over that crisis. Now we're a little bit back there again, frankly, in Europe now. Those interest rates have gone up in Europe, but there's no question that if people start to get concerned about the creditworthiness of a country or of sovereign nation, they'll only buy that debt if they pay higher interest rates. Now, right now, our interest rates are rock bottom. Couldn't be much lower. So we're in a nice position right now in that we're issuing a lot of bonds and it's a very low interest rates, but that can change.
Right. I want to go to a caller now. Eric is in Anchorage, and did you have a comment?
Yes, I actually had a question. When President Obama wanted to pull out from Afghanistan, knowing that there's a lot of soldiers over there who joined the army and the armed services to stop the unemployment rate. If they come back, how will that affect the unemployment rate?
So in other words, if we draw down our foreign entanglements with the military, does that affect unemployment? Scott, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah. Well, I think that it would drive up the unemployment rate marginally. But the unemployment problem that the country faces right now is a massive one. Depending on how you measure the number of unemployed, it's upwards of 15 million people. And certainly if there's a cutback in the military, that would marginally increase it. But
It's already so bad. It's a small piece, yeah. Well, Scott, we started to talk a minute ago about the factors of federal spending in Alaska and which might be more stable and which might be more variable. Maybe you could quantify for us in general terms, what is the biggest portion of the money? Is it military spending? Is it Social Security? Or where does that money come from?
The two biggest portions are military spending, and that's about 30 to 35%, and support for state and local government, which is another about 30%. So those are the two biggest single factors. When I say support for state and local government, I mean grants and transfers, things like the federal portion of Medicaid, support for highway construction, support for other kinds of transportation construction. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of operations and capital expenditures. But those are the two biggest pieces of the pie.
And what about the famous, you know, the earmarks or the legislatively directed items? Senator Stevens is so famous for those, and there was always concern, you know, after Senator Stevens leaves, we'll have an economic downturn. Is that a realistic fear that the loss of those kinds of funds would affect our economy?
Well, I think that the danger or our vulnerability lies in those two areas, military spending and grants to governments. And therein is where most of the earmarks lie. But it's not only earmarks that potentially could be affected. Depending on how they're measured, earmarks might represent $300 to $400 million today. But I think our vulnerability in those two areas
sounds like a lot, but out of $10 billion, it's only 4%.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're on the receiving end of one of those.
Right, $100 billion here, $100 billion there, and soon you're talking about real money. Yeah. So, so those are pretty. Those are discretionary in the sense that the Congress can decide from or military leaders can decide from one year to the next where they want to put those resources.
Well, that's right. And if you remember back a few years ago, there was a round of base closures, and Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks was on the list for closure, and it was saved at the last minute. But that. is an example of how Congress can affect the economy of the state in a big way.
Now I'd like to go to the phones. Caroline, you had a question, I think, about why we're discussing the issue, or what was your question?
You had said, Charles, you had said something about keeping it out of politics, but I'm curious as to why the discussion is coming up now, because during the time of Senator Stevens, we certainly had major deficits as a proportion of the overall economy, which may have been as great as they are now. Perhaps we're just at the end of the fueled or whatever party, and now we're having to deal with this. My concern a number of years ago, and the reason I stopped supporting our senator after many years, was we just seemed to be so greedy. You know, it didn't matter what was going on as long as he brought home the bacon. And I heard this from everyone. And so my concern at the time is not that we were going to be at the bottom of the barrel, but we were going to be under the barrel based upon how much percentage of money we got back from how much we gave to the feds. It's like an 8-to-1 difference. And I know the validity of what comes up here, but at the same time, we're part of the United States, not part of the state of Alaska only. That doesn't come first in the eyes of a lot of people. So, yeah, we've got a huge problem now. And the Chinese get a lot of, they get listened to a lot because, you know, we stop offshoring all our jobs, then, you know, the international community wants to take us on too because our debts are so great to other countries. One third, I think, of our debt is to China. And, of course, that's scary.
Right. So, well, and I don't want to clarify what I was saying.
Is this not coming up now because it's politically driven?
Well, when I said I didn't want to make it political, I was saying that I didn't want to do a show about the upcoming election. Oh, we don't have the candidates here, and that what I wanted to do is educate people about an issue that's really important for our economy. Maybe isn't important as oil and gas in Alaska because of the huge amount of money that's involved, and that it's a really interesting one for us, as you highlighted, between our desires as Alaskans and our sort of responsibilities as Americans, and how we see this. But you know, the how has this, turning to Jeff, how has this issue evolved over the years? Because the deficits have gone up and down, and I guess they went up quite a bit during the Reagan years, during his tax cuts and military buildup. Clinton brought the deficits down. They went back up during the Bush years. Now with the recession and the spending on the recession, they've gone up even more. Has this been an issue of equal importance through time, or is it more important now than it has been in the past? What's your view?
Well, my view is it's way more important now. I mean, you're right. We have run budget deficits, but, you know, say anywhere between maybe 1% and 5% of GDP would have been roughly where our budget deficits were. And right, during the Reagan years, we pushed up against that 5%. They came back down during the Clinton years. You know, the kind of the dot-com boom helped a little bit with that. But now we've turned and gone up. And it's happening at a time, though, when, you know, again, it's not just cyclical. We're suddenly now the baby boomers are retiring. You know, I think the youngest baby boomer is 65, and they're just starting to retire now. And so they're, you know, really imposing now on the federal government looking for benefits. And that's really what's one of the main reasons which is really driving these long-term budget deficits is this more secular issues associated with the entitlement programs. And couple that with the crises we've been in, and you now have, you know, you're really right up against it. And so, you know, when I said earlier, you know, it's really a political solution, it seems to me it is. I mean, we really do need the Democrats and the Republicans to get together and to come up with some good long-term fixes as to how to solve this deficit. Now, there is a budget deficit commission, you know, going to report back in December. President Obama appointed that commission. We'll have some ideas from that, but certainly, we need to, there's not a lot, the options are straightforward. you have to somehow increase some taxes, maybe cut some benefits.
That's what I was going to ask. If you were the king, you'd have two choices, right? Increase taxes or cut some of these major entitlements or military spending. Where do you see that happening? How would you do it if you were the king?
Oh, well, that's if I were the king.
I told you there would be hard questions.
The problem is it's the politics, of course, and the lack of bipartisanship and all of that.
Right.
I'll play king for a day or half an hour.
Right.
Currently the Bush tax cuts, for example, are set to expire at the end of the year, and there's been a lot of talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually extend those tax cuts for 2 years on a temporary basis and then let them all expire. I mean, that to me, the problem is we can't raise taxes now because the economy is so weak.
Right.
You know, this is the dilemma we're in.
That's why
we're spending so much money. So my thing would be, let's extend those tax cuts for 2 years permanently, and let's make them permanent. Make sure everybody understands that, but then they go away. And at the same time, start trying to work away at some of the spending and some of the entitlement reforms to try and close that budget deficit. I think if you did that, there'd be a sense, I think, by the public, maybe by investors, that we're doing something to fix this long-term deficit, and maybe that would instill confidence. You know, you mentioned confidence earlier, and maybe that would instill some confidence in the part of individuals and investors that, you know, we're okay in the long term. Maybe we could start to spend a little more now. Maybe we could start to, you know, provide some jobs, you know, do some entrepreneurship, that kind of thing. Right now, I think people are uncomfortable. You know, there's uncertainty out there, and that's one of the uncertainties is those big, longer-term budget deficits.
And I want to invite listeners to get involved in this conversation. It's a broad-reaching one, and I'm sure most people have opinions and probably have questions for our experts. The number here is 550-8433. That is the local number, 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752, and always enjoy receiving emails as well at hometownalaska@kska.org. Turning back to you, Scott Goldsmith, I want to hear your thoughts on this deficit issue, and whether you, as economists, think that the deficit is a concern right now, or if, like some economists, think, you're in this deep of a hole. You need to be deficit spending to get out of it and deal with it later, and maybe you could. And then I also, well, answer that question. Then I'll ask you another one.
Well, over the long term, the federal budget should balance. In other words, we shouldn't be running a deficit or a surplus. But we're in an unusual situation right now with high unemployment and in a recession, and we need to stimulate the economy to get it moving, and in a situation like that, it's appropriate to run a deficit, and that's what we're doing. Tax receipts are down, spending is up, and that's an appropriate government response to a recessionary situation. We've got to try to get people back into the workplace.
Mm-hmm. What about these structural issues that Jeff Pentages is raising? How do we are those things that need to be addressed for the long-term fiscal health of the country?
Jeff is absolutely right. The biggest structural problems we have looking forward are Social Security and Medicare, and those are primarily driven by the aging of the population, the baby boomers. And looking ahead, if we don't adopt some changes, increases in taxes, or reductions in benefits, we're going to be running deficits as far out in the future as one can see. And so there has to be some combination of those things.
Right.
But we need to put them in place looking forward, but not today.
Not now, right. I think you're in agreement on that. This is a question I don't know if you can answer, but in light of the fact that Alaska gets far more money than we pay in our taxes, in other words, more money's coming back to our state than we pay in by some multiple, as she said, 8 to 1, I don't know if it's that high.
Probably about 1.5 to one, okay, or two to one.
So when if you're when a person is concerned about a tax increase, from Alaska's point of view, I think we'd rather have a tax increase than a cut in spending because, you know, we 50% ahead that way. Is that true or not?
Well, that's kind of a simplistic way of looking at it. I think if our federal taxes were increased by $1 billion in Alaska, I don't think we could predict that
we'd get more.
We'd get $2 billion back. We might get nothing back because, first of all, we don't have that many old people in the state compared to other places. Uh-huh. So Medicare payments, Social Security payments are unlikely to be affected. And so I don't think it works that simply. And the other thing I'd say is that you can't look at dollars paid to the federal government compared to dollars coming back to Alaska and say, oh, we're getting more than our fair share, we're not getting our fair share. It's a lot more complicated than that. You have to look program by program.
Right. You know, for example, on the federal highways, I think it's much higher than that.
In the federal highways, it's much higher. But, you know, take military spending. Mm-hmm. You know, there are logical reasons why we have our bases where we do. And, you know, Alaska just happens to be in a fortunate position.
There are some logical reasons. There's also illogical reasons.
Well, there may be some illogical reasons, but probably people in Kansas may feel a little bit more comfortable knowing that our northern borders are protected.
I got you. Okay, I want to go to Vince. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
I've been involved in government contracting for a long time and had the great pleasure of listening to Senator Stevens and Congressman Young and I speaking about Alaskan appropriations. And speaking to the lady that spoke to you last, I'd have to say this. All you need to do, as they would say, is look to the history of Alaska. And at the time of statehood, the understanding was clearly there that the United States would have to put a good deal of investment into Alaska, as it was remote, did not have the infrastructure that the other states had, but it represented a vast wealth of mineral opportunity and resource opportunity. And so it was a conscious investment on the part of Congress to bring Alaska into statehood, but with a very clear understanding that for the foreseeable future and beyond, that there would need to be a significant investment and that Alaska would be a tenant state, more or less.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there was a recognition that Alaska really, or at least a belief that Alaska wouldn't be able to pay its way. And until oil was found at Prudhoe Bay, Alaska was really in financial trouble as a state. But I wonder if that is still true. I mean, we are, and maybe there's a question for you, Scott. Aren't we the richest state in the country in terms per capita? We've got what $40 billion in the bank in the permanent fund. I mean, surely we could pay for some of our services.
Well, this is a touchy subject. Should Alaskans pay taxes when we have a $40 billion savings account?
I'm saying in terms of, you know, the argument is made frequently that, yeah, we get a lot from the federal government, but we should because it's a big state and it's hard to do services. But we also have this money gusher from Prudhoe Bay that we've been milking for the last 30 years. And so maybe we can't really make that argument anymore.
Well, the permanent fund was set up to serve as a savings account because we know that our tax base, which is essentially petroleum, is not going to last forever. And we're going to need some alternative source of revenues when the oil money is gone. And that's really what the permanent fund is for. It's not really to be spent entirely today.
I shouldn't have brought that sacred cow into the conversation, but in terms of of just the argument that we still deserve more than our share from the federal treasury because of it's a difficult to govern state and it's expensive.
I think there is truth to that argument. We're a very diverse state. We're very widely dispersed geographically. Costs of providing public services and building infrastructure is very high. And we did start out as a state with very little of it, and we started at least 50 years behind every other state except Hawaii. So in terms of infrastructure, yes, I think we can make an argument for that.
All right. Of course,
are other arguments as well why we receive a large amount of money from the feds every year.
Interesting discussion. Thanks for calling, Vince. We're going to move on. We've got other callers and some emails. And when we come back from the break, we'll be taking on those and taking more callers and more discussion. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
All right, we're back on Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I have two guests with me today to talk about the topic of federal spending in Alaska, both from the national economic standpoint and from the Alaska economic standpoint. Jeff Pantages is Chief Investment Officer for Alaska Permanent Capital Management, which is an institutional investing firm here in Anchorage. Scott Goldsmith is a professor with the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research. And we've had some callers, and Jake has been waiting for quite a while, so I wanted to give him a chance. Jake, did you have a comment?
Yes, thanks. I had heard a comment earlier that basically, I don't recall who was saying it, sorry, but that what should be done as a means to instill confidence was that we should enshrine the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, for another 2 years and then permanently get rid of them as a means of addressing the deficit concerns. And honestly, this doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. The idea that we should continue to keep the tax cuts for the highest, you know, the highest income people, like people making over $250,000 a year, as a means of reducing the deficit is, well, I mean, it's quite backwards. The idea that people that are making this amount of, take-home pay being taxed back at the 2000 levels, which is basically what we're talking about here, raising it just to the 2000 levels, I mean, which is still extremely low, that is going to somehow damage our economic recovery. Okay, well, which is it? Are you concerned about the economic recovery, or are you concerned about the deficits? Because these generally are the same people that are constantly making claims that we have to worry about the deficit, and at the same time, oh, well, we can't possibly raise taxes for at least this group. And, I mean, the long-term analysis projection is that just raising the taxes back to the 2000 levels for that group, making $250,000 or more, would bring in 700 or some odd billion dollars over the course of, 10 years or something? So, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, okay. So that's a good point. We got two emails much on the same topic. This person says, why should we extend the federal tax cuts for the wealthy when the nation's wealthiest families' incomes have doubled and tripled in a time when working class people are suffering from unemployment and reduced earning overall? And asks, is this an example of trickle down? And another person, a little levity here, perhaps. At least I don't know what the person had in mind. But leave tax cuts for the middle class, raise taxes for the rich, legalize and tax drugs, at least marijuana. That would at least raise some money for certain parts of Alaska. But Jeff, you've said, you don't think we should be raising taxes now. And the idea, I guess, of letting the Bush tax cuts sunset or stop is a form of raising taxes.
Yeah.
Explain your reasoning, because, I've heard the argument that, well, the rich are only going to put the money in the bank anyway, so you don't need to give them a tax cut, give a tax cut to the lower income people who are going to spend it.
Yeah. Well, right. And you're trying to have it both ways, in a sense, because, you know, you've got a weak economy that's struggling, and yet we have these long-term fiscal problems that we have to somehow address at some point. And so, you know, if you let these tax cuts sunset, in some ways it may help the deficit, probably does. It could reduce growth, of course, and that's what we're worried about and what the implications of that would be. And we get into this endless debate, of course, about, you know, what should we do, what should we do? My thing was, if we can extend those tax cuts for 2 years for everyone, it helps the economy, okay? Then let them sunset. Everyone then is going to see a little bit of a tax increase. But you know what? We all kind of got to chip in and do something here. I mean, we lived beyond our means for many years. And so we all kind of got to chip in and help reduce this deficit and pay a little more in taxes. So to me, that seems like a kind of a little bit of a reasonable thing to do. Now, the tax on the rich, you know, families below or above $250,000, I think that's sort of the definition these days, I guess, of what we're talking about. I think the caller was pretty right in that that tax on those individuals, if over 10 years, is worth about $700 billion. Now, if we increase the taxes on everybody, you know, let the Bush tax cuts expire on everybody below that level, you're talking about $3.1 trillion. That's a lot. I mean, that would go a long way to help our deficit. It wouldn't at all eliminate them at all, but it would be a step sort of in the right direction.
So that's sort of 10-year numbers.
10-year numbers, you're right, 10-year numbers. So that's kind of a step in the right direction. So I'm trying to find common ground, right?
Finding out how difficult that is.
Yeah.
Jake, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the common ground seems to be fairly obviously that you start with the tax cuts for, you know, leaving in the tax cuts for the next 2 years for the people making less than $250,000, and then make a case after that, after the economic recovery has proceeded, hopefully, that after 2 years, yeah, maybe then everybody has expired. But why would you grant, I mean, the people who need it the least, basically, and yes, there's this theory of trickle-down economics, granted. That's the theory that got us to where we are, basically. That's the whole economic, you know, fantasy land, I think, that has shown us, you know, that has gotten us to this point. And that's, most studies show that the people, like you said, that, I mean, putting money in the bank isn't necessarily an intrinsically bad thing. I mean, that, you know, banks use that money to give out loans. Okay, fine, that's great. And also they put in investments in the stock market, and the stock market needs that, sure. But they also tend to, I mean, a lot of the money that gets spent at that level, at the really extremely super rich levels, is the is wasted on luxury goods. They don't help anybody, right? I mean, who, you know, another Porsche or whatever. It's nothing that's going to actually stimulate the economy.
Except it helps, like, the guy who works at the Porsche dealership.
Well, yeah, that's great. There's this little stratosphere, you know, of people that enjoy it, but for the most people don't actually get to benefit from that. And that's, yeah, I realize, trickle down, right?
Yeah, I got you. Well, I think you made your point, and we're going to move on, but thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks.
All right, great. And for other people who want to get involved, the number here is 550-8433. That's the in-town number. Hometown Alaska at KSKA.org is the email address. And since I've got two experts here, I want to see if a pet theory of mine is correct, which is this. When you're in a situation where money is available for, you know, 1%, 2%, in other words, very low interest rates, your problem is really one of encouraging consumption rather than encouraging investment. In other words, you can get the money that you need to do business these days. We're not worried about accumulating more capital and you know, tax cuts for the rich, and that sort of idea being that you want to have more money in those people's hands to so that they can stimulate economic activity through investment, because the money is available. What you need to do is get people to be spending money so that people get jobs and you get more economic activity going on. Is that true, Scott Goldsmith?
I think that's true. The Federal Reserve is pushed interest rates down as far as they can in an attempt to stimulate the economy. And there's just a lot of money that's sitting around in banks because even though the rates are very cheap, business is not stepping up to the plate and investing. And I think a lot of the reason is because consumers are many of them unemployed, or they got so far overextended. Borrowing on the value of their housing that disappeared, or they're just feeling cautious because they don't know what's around the next corner economically. So There needs to be a stimulus to consumption, in my mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, and people have used the phrase, you know, the Federal Reserve is pushing on a string at this point. I mean, meaning they pushed interest rates as low as they can go. They're pushing reserves into the system. We're really not seeing that in terms of growth in the money supply or loans, actually. So banks are sitting on a lot of that cash, and they're just holding it as reserves at the Federal Reserve. One of the things about consumers is, you know, we have gone through this wrenching recession. It was a financial panic. We accumulated a lot of debt over the years. This has been building. Mm-hmm. You know, this panic mm-hmm. just didn't happen. I mean, it happened overnight, but it's been building as we accumulated more and more debt at the consumer level, at business levels, within the banking system. You know, the finance guys call that leverage. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of leverage in the system, and there still is. And it's going to take a few years to work off that leverage. Consumers are paying down their debt now, and business has done a little bit of that as well. So that's kind of happening. And when you're saving more and paying down your debt, you're not spending.
You're not buying stuff. And so that's the guy at the Porsche dealer's out of a job.
Yeah, and my view of the the future is that's kind of the way it's going to be for a while, and we just got to gut it out. I mean, that's what happens when mm-hmm. you live beyond your means. You got to change your lifestyle a little bit. And that's kind of what we have to do. And it's unfortunate. The government stepped in to do as much as they can. But that's kind of where we are right now. So it's going to take a while. There's no magic bullets.
Doesn't matter too much who's in office or what they're doing. Yeah. Okay.
Well, part of the danger right now is that the original stimulus package has pretty much worked its way through the system. Mm-hmm. And looking forward, it's unclear whether we're going to have any additional stimulus funding coming out of Washington. And if we don't...
Pretty unlikely, it looks like.
If we don't, it's going to be bad news for consumers, as far as I'm concerned. It's going to really slow down the very modest recovery that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Now let me bring this back for a minute to the Alaska situation. In turning to you, Scott, because I know that you know so much about how the Alaska economy works. Our housing prices did not crash as they did elsewhere. They've stayed relatively stable. Our unemployment numbers, while not great, are sort of nowhere near as bad as they are in other places. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is in part because we have such an unusual economy that's based on federal spending. It's based on oil and gas. And these are sort of money sources driving the economy that are relatively immune from the ups and downs of the national economy. Is that true?
Well, it is true. If you look back historically, you can see that when the nation has been in recession, generally Alaska has been doing well. And you're right on. It's because we're dependent on oil and primarily through the price of oil. When the price goes up for us, it's good times, generally. When mm-hmm. the price goes up in the rest of the country, it's bad times. And it's also our dependence on the federal government, because that tends to be a pretty stable part of the economy. I mean, it's been growing for as long as I've been here. It's just a matter of
30 or 40 years,
how fast it's been growing or how slow it's been growing. But it's a pretty dependable source of revenues.
And then the rest of the basic economy, how large is oil and gas as a portion of the basic economy compared to federal spending?
Well, it's about the same size as federal spending. It's about a third. So
that takes care of two-thirds.
Yeah, two-thirds of the jobs can be traced to those two industries, and the other third can be traced to mining, tourism, fishing, and a few other resource-producing industries, as well as our small but growing senior population.
So in terms of Alaska's economic future, we're tied to national fortunes in that as long as they need oil, as long as we still have oil and we have a product that's going through the pipeline, and as long as they still need national defense and we're still where we are, I mean, it's in a sense a totally different equation than the national economic equation. Is that true?
That's right.
But that doesn't mean we don't have bad times ahead if we don't. Yeah.
Well, that's true too. But nationally, manufacturing is an important industry, and that's almost non-existent up here, except for fish processing and a financial sector, a service sector. We have them, but they're not as large or important as they are in the rest of the of the U.S. But we are, over time, looking more and more like the rest of the U.S. in terms of our economy. So we've got a large and growing healthcare sector, which is similar to the rest of the U.S. And we have a much larger retail sector than we had in years past.
We are talking with Scott Goldsmith, professor with the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research, and Jeff Pantages, Chief Investment Officer for Alaska Permanent Capital Management Company. And I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic is federal spending in Alaska, the economics of it. Last chance to get your calls in, 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or email hometownalaska@kska.org. Jeff, you analyze investment opportunities, and we haven't talked about this before, so I don't know what you're what you would say. But how do you view Alaska as an investment, a place to invest money, as compared to the national and international economy? I mean, are you bullish on Alaska in terms of our economic future, or do some of these issues like the decline of Prudhoe Bay and the question marks around federal spending give you any qualms?
They do get me a little bit worried. You know, I mean, I think the fact is we are quite a bit dependent on the natural resource sector. I mean, oil and gas in particular, oil in particular. And, you know, as when I came up here 5 years ago, I looked at our dependence on oil and gas, and I said, oh, well, we have to diversify. I mean, I'm an investment guy. I mean, it's diversification, diversification, diversification. That's what you're supposed to do. But having lived here for 5 years, I kind of am thinking, well, maybe Andrew Carnegie was right. Remember, he was a big industrialist, a steel guy, and he said the key to business success is to put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket carefully. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, natural resources, oil and gas, that's where we are in this state, really. And we need to focus our attention on that and do everything we can to support those kind of industries because they're so important to us. Federal spending, you know, is a stabilizing factor, but it's, you know, with, as I've said, with all these budget deficits out in the future, we may see some pressure on reductions there. But we've got the permanent fund and we've got a big, big amount of reserves set aside. We've been doing a pretty good job of doing that over the last few years. So we've got some, you know, rainy day funds to keep us in pretty good shape from that perspective. But generally, a little bit concerned about where we're headed.
And let me ask you, as long as I'm asking you about things that make you nervous, looking at the national picture and at the markets, with these very low interest rates and the inability of the Fed to seeming to be able to get things going, is there a real danger of deflation, the opposite of inflation, where which in many ways is, I guess, is a pretty scary thing for an investor when the money, when the dollar gets worth increasingly more money, debts get, you know, changes the whole equation. Is that something that you see as a real possibility out there?
You know, it's something to think about. You know, I've worried about a thousand things in my life, most of which never came true, you know, that, so, I mean, I think it is something, you know, you do want to pay attention to, and certainly the Federal Reserve is really paying attention to that. I mean, they're concerned about deflation. They want to make sure that we have some level of inflation. And the reason people worry about deflation is really twofold. I mean, one of them is if you have falling prices, falling consumer prices, I'm talking about now, not the stock market, but falling prices, you know, if consumers start to expect that, then they think, well, why would I spend money now on something? I'll wait until it's lower priced. And that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the economy starts to slowly slow down. And also, you know, when you have deflation, if you're in debt, that's tough.
The dollar gets harder to get to pay back that debt.
You got to pay back that fixed interest expense, and yet your dollars are going down in terms of wages and salaries and other things. So that's also a concern given the amount of debt we have in the economy. And the Fed's on the case. I mean, they don't want that to happen. So they're trying to do everything they can to, again, push up the economy. Now, frankly, a couple of weeks ago, they came out and pretty much said just that we want a little more inflation. Well, that got people worried on the other side, because it was like, oh, what's that going to mean? I mean, is that going to mean that, you know, our U.S. dollar is worth less? So the dollar started to tank in international markets. So so we're in a very difficult kind of position right now. Look, we are in recovery. You know, the National Bureau of Economic Research research said so. You know, a week ago they said we're out of recession,
so
and we were out.
Must be true.
Must be true. In July of 2009, we came out of recession. But these things following financial crisis, they're usually pretty, you know, it's fits and starts, it's sluggish, it's going to take a while, things can go wrong, but you know, we're kind of on the right track, but, you know.
I was kind of thinking that 2 years after, the bike wouldn't be wobbling quite as much as it is, you know. I'd like to see it zooming down the road a little bit better. Here's a email correspondent who's listening to the show who is pulling this back to a much broader perspective, and it's one that I'm somewhat in sympathy, which is the writer's question is, can America and the world continue exploiting our natural resources, water, timber, air, minerals, to profit for a few decades to come? What economy will our children and grandchildren have in the future? And just to broaden that out, you know, the idea of economic growth is what we're talking about. Everyone feels that we need growth and we need to have the economy getting continuously larger. And yet the earth isn't getting any larger. The resources of the earth aren't getting larger. I think there's a lot of discussion about peak oil. You know, are we going to really run out of oil? And I realize I've got two experts here who aren't necessarily, that's not their field, but I guess everybody has some opinion about this. Scott, do you have thoughts about where, I mean, are we really, is the economy sustainable permanently in the phase of growth, or do we have to think in some terms in the future that growth can't continue?
Well, we do have to think seriously about husbanding our resources. And I think in terms of our air and our water and our land. And that's a real challenge. But on the other hand, we have been very successful historically in being able to sustain economic growth. And a couple of recent examples would be the development of shale gas. It was just about 3 or 4 years ago that people were talking about the U.S. running out of natural gas supplies. And now with the technological development of shale gas on the lower 48, we're looking at a surplus. And a long-term surplus. And another example would be undersea mining, which is a totally new development where countries now are looking at going underwater to mine copper, to mine zinc, to mine products that we in Alaska think we have a lot of. There's a lot of land under the oceans where there's potential for that kind of development. So sort of being an economist, I have the two hands. So there's the on the other hand, but on the other hand, we have to worry about our technical ability to mine the fish in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And what the long-term consequences of that are. So
yeah.
There are opportunities, but they're fraught with challenges, and it'll be interesting to see how things play out.
Well, Jeff, this is the advantage of being an academic. You don't actually have to come down with the decision, right? Unlike the investor who has to actually buy or sell something. But just teasing you, Scott. But the beauty of technology is that the caller was able to send in a follow-up, which... On email and saying, you know, are the guests are assuming higher consumption is good. Is it best for the long-term health of families, economies, and nations? And I guess what she's getting at is, and if I can expand that, is we look to countries like China and India with these enormous populations that are surging economically and coming to these huge increases in quality of life. It's a lot of observers look and say, well, if they all own as many cars and use as many resources and use as much oil and gas as Americans do, which is seeming to be more and more of a reasonable prediction at the rate they're going, that there's no way that the resources can be produced at that rate. Is that the sort of thing, Jeff, that investors would ever look at, or is that sort of too pie in the sky and too far out there to think about, that we could hit a wall as the need for resources arises from these emerging economies?
Well, I don't know about, you know, the sort of the philosophy, I mm-hmm. suppose, of it all.
Sure.
I mean, I certainly think, you know, people acknowledge that China has a voracious appetite for natural resources, and the country is growing like crazy, of course, 9 or 10% growth mm-hmm. per year, and they are, you know, building what, a coal plant a week, I guess I've heard. I mean, it's amazing the kind of growth we've seen out of there. You know, I don't know, you know, the limits to growth. We always seem to be able to find new products, new ideas. I kind of generally think that, you know, growth helps everybody. You know, improves our standards of living, that kind of thing. So that's, you know, I'm of that sort of mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I apologize for pulling you both into an area that is definitely was not on the agenda. Here's another email, and I'm just trying to answer as many of these while we still have a little time left. This person is saying essentially that in terms of the Social Security system and the problem with covering that obligation, that if, I'm paraphrasing, but I think her point is that if we were to require the Social Security tax to not be capped for high earners, that would be sufficient to equalize the system and make it whole. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's along the line of some of the other callers and emailers who are saying essentially, make the wealthy pay more of the problem. And I guess I'm going to summarize it all in those terms and put it to both of you, and either of you who wants to answer first. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Is the deficit problem, is the sort of the unsustainable long-term finances of the country, can it be borne only primarily by the wealthy? Have they gotten a free ride, or is it something that's so large that everybody's going to have to take a hit? Scott, do you want to take that first?
Oh, I think it's, looking forward, it's so large that everybody is going to have to step up to the plate. If you look at Social Security, I think that relaxing the cap on taxes would help somewhat. I don't know that in itself is a solution. I think that another part of the solution is increasing the retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody's going to have to step up to the
even
plate.
Alaskans.
someday even Alaskans,
yeah.
Probably.
Jeff, did you a final comment?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think everybody needs to step up and take a little bit of share of the responsibility for the predicament we're in. Social Security, you know, you actually can go to their website, and there's a little game you can play to solve the Social Security problem, and it's actually not that hard to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's Medicare and Medicaid that really are the big issues out there. But I think everybody needs to try and, you know, help with the problem. So, yeah.
And even Alaskans. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's a great conclusion to our discussion. I want to thank my two guests, Jeff Pantages and Scott Goldsmith. I at least have found it fascinating, and we've certainly gotten a lot of response from listeners. Next week, tune in. Tika Ballas will be hosting Hometown Alaska with the first of a two-part God in Alaska, after the PBS series God in America. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.